The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The speaker is Mark Nunberg, guiding teacher at Common Ground.
Many of you are already receiving the Buddha Studies email, so you got the email this afternoon. Even if you haven't seen it, it's there. If you've been on the email list, you got that email. And it's just reminding folks that there are some good resources on loving kindness up on our webpage, which is just buddhaststudies.commongroundmeditation.org. And that link is in the email. But even if you are currently not on the email, like if this is your first Buddha Studies class, you can just go to buddhaststudies.commongroundmeditation.org. And what will show up first are the resources for this course. So there's maybe 5 articles that if you want, you can download, print up. There's some talks, the previous 2 courses on loving kindness, the talks and guided meditations are there. Caleb's here tonight, so he's recording. So that what happened tonight will be up there in a week or so. So the idea is just to dig in. Some of you have more time, some of you less time. Do it, you know, use the time you have to practice and study. Because the great thing about the universe we live in, it's lawful. If you contemplate aversion and non-aversion, love and non-love, you can't help but learn. You know, whether you do it formally in a structured way, sitting down in a quiet space, your kids and cell phone in another room, pets in other rooms, and just within that own psychic, our own psychic space, we investigate, or we take it on the road in our daily life where we're interacting with people. But either way, we'll learn a lot. And ideally, we're practicing both ways. In isolation, so that we're working within our own heart and mind. It's just so interesting how in those more private moments, in some ways, we can justify behaviors that we would never want anybody to see us acting out in the world, right? The kind of meanness we can have toward ourselves. Some of you have heard me describe this particular moment in meditation in the middle of a long retreat, 3-month retreat. And I was doing walking meditation, and my mind was wandering, and I was bringing it back, and it was wandering, bringing it back, and it wandered. And I just got so upset that this huge wave of frustration, anger just arose. But it just so happens that right with the arising of, and it was a big movement of anger, frustration, self-judgment, right with it was awareness, right? Because mindfulness had some continuity, because I was in the middle of a long retreat. So there was that very unpleasant emotion of anger, frustration, self-hatred, and a knowing of it. And being angry is not the same as knowing there is anger, right? It's different when there's that balanced, clear awareness, oh, self-hatred is like this. In fact, you'll see, if you practice this, you'll see that's the proximate cause for compassion to arise. And because my mind was pretty steady and sensitive, then the next moment, so the first moment was wandering mind, and it had some history, right? It had been wandering and come back wandering. And then the next moment was a wave of self-hatred with awareness, right? The mind recognizing that. And then that breaking the heart wide open. So the next moment was, like in my life, probably the most powerful, clear experience of compassion, right? I needed the self-hatred, right, and mindfulness in order to realize the depth and nimbleness and liberating effect of compassion. It's like the whole world opened up. Everything was connected, and it was all love. And I didn't do it. It's like I didn't like bring that thought or feeling or love to mind. It was the natural result of seeing the, it's like when awareness, when wisdom sees suffering, like self-hatred arise, then compassion follows. Because that's what opens the door of compassion, is actually being aware, intimate, unafraid to see pain and suffering for what it is. So it's pretty amazing, right? Because, you know, it seems like we're suffering all the time. It's pretty amazing to think that any moment of self-hatred, any moment of suffering could be the moment, the doorway into the love we've been looking for a long time, but just in all the wrong places. Like shaking our partners, why don't you love me the way that I want you to love me? As if that's, you know, that's the cause that will give us what we want. You know, the problem is here and the resolution is here. And we always think it's out there somewhere else, which is endlessly frustrating. So I'm just saying that to inspire us to practice both formally during the next couple of weeks and for the rest of our lives, but also informally as we go about our days. Like there's really no moment between now and whenever you think you've done enough. There's no moment that we can't find a way to practice. And you know, the image about love, or metta, usually translated as loving kindness, but really it's just that basic friendliness or that basic goodness of the heart. And the way it's talked about in the tradition is that that quality of the heart knows how to show up. That's its characteristic. So when we don't know how to be in a moment, that's not metta, right? Or we don't know how to be, but we're okay with that. That's metta, you know? So metta, like the image is how water can fill any vessel, no matter how weird the shape is. Water doesn't have any problem knowing how to fill that space. And so when the mind or heart is grounded in a more authentic non-aversion, non-fear, or what we call metta, karuna is compassion, mudita is appreciative joy, upeka is equanimity. When it's grounded in that, then the reason there are four qualities, and you know, it could be 400 qualities, but just to keep it simple, there are four qualities, is pointing to the fact that it knows how to show up. So like, if it's a really difficult moment, then it shows up as compassion. And if it's a really beautiful moment, it shows up as appreciative joy. And if it's a more ordinary moment, it shows up as basic friendliness, basic goodness. And if it's a really ambiguous moment or confusing moment, it will show up as equanimity. But one way or another, it will find a way to fill the space. It will find a way to show up and be intimate. That's the characteristic. So then that way, no matter what's going on in our life, it just begs the question, well, how might love, how might this potential we all have, we're walking around with it, this potential to be right here in the moment, intimate, connecting, receptive, and engaged and responsive. So not just passively receptive, but receiving and giving, right? There's the basic quality of generosity and all these qualities of the heart. It's a movement of both receptivity and engagement and responding appropriately to the moment. And that nimbleness or that naturalness is related to the what they're called. These four qualities of the heart are called immeasurables. Because it's, like I said earlier, it's when aversion goes away, what's left is nature not tainted by aversion, right? And nature is innumerable. Like there's no Like, where does nature begin and end? What's in nature and what's not nature? No. It's just all nature. So when we're in those moments where the compassion or the joy or the basic friendliness is real and authentic and not staged or not like I should be kind to this person, it will have that immeasurable quality, like it's just nature doing it. It's not like I'm trying to be a really nice person. If anything, those, that sense of I'm trying to be a nice person is diminishing the naturalness and the power and the lightness of the love. It doesn't contribute to it, the thought that I should be kind or I should be compassionate. And you see, it changes then how we practice, because normally when we, you know, hear about or feel inspired by loving kindness, it's like, oh yeah, I want to do that. I want to be that. How can I be that more? But this way of practicing, it may begin there, but then because we have some, at least information now, and then maybe some insight, some experience from our own lives, then it's a lot about trusting and about getting some skill about opening that door of love, of compassion. Like, what do I need to bring to mind? What do I need to pay attention to in this moment that will remind the mind of this potential of being fully present, fully connecting, responding in this immeasurable, not limited state, right? Not fear limits the mind, greed limits the mind, aversion limits the mind. But when those qualities of mind have been seen and abandoned, then what's limiting it? So there's this immeasurable or boundless quality. And that's a nice, like, barometer for love. Like, is it bound up in any way? Then it's may look like love, but maybe it's more attachment or desire. Or maybe it's sentimental and superficial. But when it has that breadth and depth, you know, being unbounded and immeasurable, has more of that flavor. It also has that anatta flavor, like not self. It's not personal. So in other traditions, like Christianity or whatever, they might say, what's God's love, divine love? So we sometimes use that word, metta, instead of love because, you know, love is sort of a corrupted term, but we can reinvent it or refresh it. You know, so when we're talking about kindness or love or compassion, like I said earlier, it's not about a particular person. It just so happens that it's being expressed with this particular person that I'm seeing right here. But it may look or feel differently as I bring other people to mind or move through the day. But the basic, unbounded, nimble way of connecting, being willing to be touched, being willing to be close, willing to respond, undefended, the mind not bound up with boundaries, who's in, who's out, or hierarchical senses. This person, they get a lot of love, this person a little less love, this person not any love at all because they scare me or because I've decided they're bad because they look different than me or they're whatever. But when we have, when the heart's really nimble in this way, even if somebody actually is dangerous and a threat and we need to get away from them, we don't have to hate them, right? Because that nimble, immeasurable heart will realize, like, even as we're running away from them because they might want to hurt us or rob us or whatever, the heart understands that, yeah, I need to get away and I care about my this life and I'm going to take care of this life, and it can't be easy being that person who wants to do me harm. That would not be a good mind or heart to have to inhabit right now. may you be well. And you becoming well and you becoming free from suffering is only going to be the benefit for the benefit of all other beings. Because when you're in this contracted and obviously suffering state, you're no good for yourself and you're definitely no good for anybody else. So may you be well. Why would we actually, with wisdom in our minds, why would we feel compelled to hate somebody? Like when we look at ill will in our minds toward politicians, toward the evildoers who run corporations, or whatever we might, you know, whoever we might have ill will for, when we really look at it, we should just take a, you know, look at it in a practical, pragmatic way. Like, what good is this? There's a very powerful story that Jack Kornfield tells of when he was in Thailand and working in, I don't know what he was doing in the refugee camps, but remember, you might remember in the early, late 70s and early 80s, it was a big deal of a lot of people leaving Laos and Cambodia, crossing the border. Many of them had lost many, many members of their family. There's millions were killed at the in the 70s there. And Maha Gosananda, this very famous, well-known Cambodian Buddhist monk, had made it across, and he was teaching the thousands and tens of thousands of people in these camps. A lot of Westerners went, some of my people that I was in college with went to these camps to help out, sort of a thing that people would do to help. And in any case, Jack Kornfield, I don't know if he was a monk at the time, but anyway, he was there. And Maha Gosananda would just have these people, they wanted to build a camp, and they had spies. The Khmer Rouge from Cambodia had spies in these refugee camps and across the border in Thailand. And the word had gone out that anybody who supports the building of these camps, you know, they're going to be killed and any relatives still in the country will be harmed. And still people gathered. And they just chanted over and over again this very famous phrase from the Dhammapada, this collection of verses from the Buddhist teachings. Hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone is healed. This is an ancient and eternal law. And people would just, he would just chant it, and then eventually everyone else was chanting it with them and crying. And because you can imagine how easy it would be to be afraid and to be hateful of hate, having lost friends and relatives, and even now, having made it out of the country, being afraid. And we could do the same. Now, our situation isn't nearly as dire, but we could do the same. I mean, we could literally, in our mind, be chanting or repeating that basic teaching. Hatred never ceases by hatred. Hatred never adds anything. Ill will, now remember, ill will includes boredom and fear and irritation and impatience. So we could be chanting this on the freeway. Ill will never ceases through ill will, but by love alone is healed. This is the ancient and eternal truth. This is the law. Like, this is a law that is never broken. We can challenge each other. Like, in these 2 weeks, you know, as we're more formally reflecting on this, let's just see, can we actually find a place where ill will, frustration, impatience, now it's totally understandable that these qualities are going to arise in our mind. So I'm not, there's no reason to be, have ill will for the ill will that arises in our mind. But when it does arise, to really see, has it any function whatsoever? Does it contribute anything? Because a lot of times, and many of you have heard this, we ask, sometimes people ask out loud in the group, you know, if we're not angry, we're not going to do anything about racial injustice, or we're not going to do anything about global warming or the other inequities in our society. Don't we need anger to affect change in our lives, in our societies, in the world? Isn't it true? And this is what we need to check out in a very direct and pragmatic way. Can we find examples where ill will, anger, throwing somebody out of our heart actually contributes to the well-being of beings, sets something good in motion? And we'll have more time next week to talk, but to really look at all the little and big ways we rationalize ill will. I don't remember why, but we were listening to, Gwen and I were listening to something today. Oh, Mitch McConnell was being interviewed on Minnesota Public, not on Minnesota Public Radio, but he was being it was being played on the public radio. And he comes from a coal state, and so he's always been pro coal. And then it brought to mind the Koch brothers. Thanks. Koch brothers. And, you know, it's just easy to sort of bring certain people or certain institutions to mind and assume that it's like, yeah, there's just some force that needs to be moved, stopped, right? Like people who have a lot of money and using that money to perpetuate their self-interests. And then it's just interesting to see, like, can that, you know, in a way, hating or judging people like that is an excuse for non-action, I find. It's like we think that judging them as being bad, like I've done something productive, and so I don't really have to do anything. You know, all those Southerners who still have racism, you know, we can shake our head about those deep South states or something like that, and somehow it takes us, you know, like we're not responsible for looking deeply in our heart about what's, you know, what's there, what hasn't been seen yet. And the thing about when we let the heart be touched by the injustices and the unskillful actions and the people using their wealth for their own self-interest, we want to let it in, right? That's what love allows. Hate keeps it out, right? Because we tell ourselves something like they're bad. And then we don't have to engage and respond and act. The way action comes is we let the heart be touched. We have to feel that touch. We have to be moved. The heart has to be moved. And this isn't self. This is nature. It's just like the law, the way it works. Isn't it? Wouldn't it be true, you know, if we saw, and this is what motivates so many saintly people, is that they didn't want to, but they just saw too much, and they couldn't help but use their life. They couldn't help but respond. And their life has basically these twists and turns of them responding. And then that response leads to something, and then that's a little bit more information, and then they respond, and they go forward in life. So this is our kind of call to action these 2 weeks, and then from there on, is just to take, and I think it, even though it's not as juicy to talk about aversion and non-aversion, but non-hate, non-aversion is in a way a more direct and immediate way into the world of love, compassion, appreciative joy, equanimity. To really get tuned in to all the different ways we close the heart down, that we throw people out of our heart, feel like it's not safe, that we don't know how to include. We don't know how to care. We're not wanting to respond, have to respond. And just to see, in a way that feels safe, because you want to build on success, what today, this hour, what can I include that my heart would otherwise want to be averse to or afraid of or close itself off to? What can I include? Who can I include? Who can I be a little closer to? What can I be a little closer to? And just start to see the different movements. And then to notice, like, is that a movement of compassion or basic friendliness? Or is that a movement of joy? Is the quality of love expressed now as equanimity, like a willingness in ambiguous situations, a willingness to stay right in the middle, knowing that I don't know how to respond yet. So I need to be equanimous because I don't have enough clarity yet. And so in that place of equanimity, I care enough, I love enough to be willing to be sensitive until nature moves through me, right? And I stand up and say something, or I sit down and listen, or I, you know, send some money or clean the bathroom, but one way or another, we're moved to respond to the life situation as it is. And, you know, we always think it has to be big, but, you know, it couldn't be very simple and small. Or it has to be about other people suffering. There's a story in the tradition about some robbers, some thugs in some place, and they felt the need to have to show the community that they mean business and that people should just basically give them what they want. And the thing they could do that would prove that is kill one of the monks, right? Because if you're willing to kill a monk, like in a Buddhist context, that would be obscene. Like, you don't do that. And so if they killed a monk, then people would really respect them and basically they wouldn't have to, like, kill anymore, or that people would just give them their money because, my God, they killed a monk. So they went to the elder monk, the teacher monk, and they said, we need to kill one of you, but we don't really care who it is, so you can choose. And so that there's the abbot, and there's a really old monk, and then there's a monk that nobody liked, you know. And there's a monk that was really sick, and maybe a few others. And then the question is, like, well, who does the chief monk choose? You know, and being all politically correct, we go, well, you wouldn't choose the one you hate or don't like or that irritates you because, you know, that would be bad. I just finished reading a book, Harriet McBride, I think, wrote it. I think that's how she says her last name. But she was someone who has used a wheelchair her whole life and has a very, very significant disability. She's dead now. And was quite well known. There was a wonderful article that was published in the New York Times Magazine about her interactions with Peter Singer, a famous philosopher some of you might know, who's like the nth degree of a utilitarian philosopher. And he's very strong in animal rights. But he's really controversial because he's raised questions about children who are born with serious disabilities that are going to require a lot of care throughout their life, and that money could be better spent on, you know, just benefiting the lives of many people, like children who don't have enough food, good nutrition, or who have diseases that could be easily fixed with some medicine that's readily available, but there's no money. And yet we'd spend you know, this money to do this. I was talking to a friend of mine, and he has some wealthy relatives that started this this very amazing place for children with autism, and they're very wealthy, these people, and so this institution just has the best resources. And children might be there for, these are people with pretty severe autism, and they may be there for a few years and just be able to speak a few more sentences than they would otherwise, not having been at that place. And so Peter Singer is, you know, really wants to create rules or laws that would allow parents to choose to kill a child with, you know, a lot of disabilities or really disabled, would need a lot of care, a lot of expensive care through their lives. And so he had this really interesting conversation with this woman, Harriet McBride, who's this very, you know, had a lot of limitations in terms of mobility and other health, serious health concerns. But she's a very charming and sharp lawyer. And I forget where they met, but anyway, he invited her to Princeton to have this conversation. And she accepted. And a lot of the people in the disability rights community, and she was a big leader in that community, thought, like, this guy's the evil doer. He's the evil doer. And you shouldn't even have a conversation with them. And this, you can probably find this article online, because it was in the New York Times maybe about 15 years ago. And it's a chapter in her book, and I can't remember the title of her book right now. These people who we have every reason to feel threatened by or to want to throw out of our heart. But when you start to connect with them, you realize they're a human being. And their idea to you may be really wrong, the ideas that they advocate, but that they're a human being. And maybe from their perspective, what they're thinking or whatever makes sense. And it doesn't mean you don't try to stop them or change them, but you don't throw them out of your heart. And it was just so interesting to see her, like, liking this guy that she really wanted to hate. And that she didn't, you know, it wasn't that he's a perfect guy, but just that was her nature. She was just like a really lovely human being. And, although she didn't have too many nice words for Jerry Lewis. She protested for many years the muscular dystrophy. Was that what he had the telethon for? And but she probably didn't have any nice words for him because I don't think she ever met him. That would have been an interesting conversation between her and him as well, but another story. Oh, I don't think there's an end to the story, except that... that it was that conundrum, like, there's nobody to pick. That's what he came to. Like, initially he thought, well, I should just pick myself. You know, first, the first thought, of course, is the person that irritates you. And then generally the utilitarian point of view comes to mind. Sorry, I didn't finish the story, right? It's like, oh, okay, we'll get rid of either the sick one or the old one. Who has the greatest probability for the greatest number of, you know, pleasant days, and we'll get the other guy, kill the other guy. And then, oh no, I should take myself. That would be the noble thing to do. But I think the point of the story is that there's nobody that you can choose. So maybe it's random, but not to think that some, like, that idea that one life is better than another life. Because that's the beginning, you know, that's the beginning of aversion. This is a story I've told before, so maybe many of you have heard it, but Andy Olensky, I'll make it short because I know a lot of you have heard it, a well-known teacher, and there was a rabid skunk that had gotten in his house, and then they got it out, and his little son, his young son, got his bow and arrow, and Andy, big guy running around his boxer shorts on Saturday morning out in his backyard wanted to kill the skunk so that it wouldn't bite at somebody else's dog. They were in a place with a lot of homes and a lot of pets. But he found, and he was somebody who's been really looking at his mind for a long time, that he couldn't do what seemed like the right thing to do without hate in his mind. Now, even though it was probably the right thing to do, there was hate in the mind. And so sometimes we may be in a situation where we do need to kill a being or harm somebody. And we have to, Kamala Masters, the woman I was teaching with out at IMS this last week, and a few other people, we were talking about this in terms of roaches. We were talking about Hawaii and roaches, and IMS had a roach problem, and we were talking about bugs and about killing bugs. And Kamala summed it up in a really, I thought, just right way. Yeah, sometimes we will end up killing. And in that moment, in a very generous way, we receive the karma of that killing. Right? We don't deny it. We don't pretend that we're not receiving the fruit of that action of hatred or killing. We receive it in full awareness. I'm willing, like if your house gets termites and for whatever reason you can't afford to just let them eat the house, and so you hire someone to bomb it with the fumes, whatever that they do, then the wise thing to do is to realize that I consciously take on whatever karma that is, and we won't necessarily know, obviously, what that is. But whatever that is, that fear, that hate, that wanting those bugs to go away, whatever that ongoing effect is in the mind stream, I accept that. I accept that. And the same thing with all the ways that we participate, whether it's eating meat or squashing a mosquito, you're in the tent, you're exhausted, you hiked 15 miles with a 50-pound backpack. You're not going to catch that mosquito and get it outside. You put your arm out, it lands, and you kill it. You want to do that in awareness if you're going to do it. Because there's even the effect on our heart, and this is for us to check out on our own, not to just believe blindly. But to be unaware of the karma is its own karma. So given that we live in the world where we are going to cause harm, we should be really aware of it. That's why, like when we end up saying something to our partner, I find this hard to do. You know, when we act out our own negativity, our own hurtness, and in a way that hurts another person, then we should acknowledge it or confess it because we want to feel the karmic effect of having been harmful. So it doesn't creep up on us later. We want to feel it right now and in that moment. Let me receive. You could even use that when you're careless around a spider and you squash it. You're pretending to get it outside, but you're not really being careful. And there it goes. Or like I notice with me, it's when I'm vacuuming, right? Because you know, when I'm vacuuming, and I know where the spiders reside, and I can go slowly and give them a chance to get out of the way, but I can pretend, you know, or how much light I have on when I'm vacuuming. Like, do you really want to see those smaller ones? So, to do these things in the full light of awareness, so like we receive it, so that, because that's a kind of compassion to receive like the poignancy of living in a world where we do cause harm and we do kill. And are we going to receive that and really, and then let it change who we are? Because we become different when we let it in. We become a different person as we move forward. So I'll leave it here and we'll pick it up next week. But we have about 10 minutes. It'd be nice to hear some examples about looking at those places where we have boundaries, where we choose to be unaware of harming, or we justify aversion, we justify hatred, it seems to make sense. So it would be nice to hear from people, or of course, any questions you might have. So what comes to mind about love and aversion? First, Leela, and we have our mic here. If people don't mind, it just makes it easier for everyone to hear.
Make sure you point it right at your mouth.
Sit back. Stephen. Right behind you, Jim.
I just think we need to be so careful about forgiveness. I have a sister who walks with anger, and I assumed that one of her daughters disappeared off the face of the earth because her mother was so full of anger, and her mother and the daughter never did anything right, quote unquote. So I, in all my wisdom, said to this sister when she came to see me, I forgive you for all the hurt that you've caused Donna. And she said, fuck you. And I got the message. I mean, you know, there was all kinds of superiority in me. There was all kinds of, you did it all wrong. And that was the most one of the most important hurtful lessons, hurtful, I hurt. I mean, so I have never felt that I needed to forgive anybody because they're doing what they do. And how many times have I been unable to be big enough to see what is the best thing to do or whatever? So being forgiving is something that I really have to think about.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it's the best. It's a non-solution because the solution is here.
Yeah. So you could talk about it instead of forgiving, you know, that word, again, it gets misused. It's really about, like, I'm not going to hold resentment towards you or judgment to you. So that when I forgive you, it's like I'm not going to keep you separate from me anymore. I'm not going to keep that boundary up anymore that you were bad or you harmed me.
I think what I feel is that I have to forgive myself for not being big enough to see that she is where she is.
Yeah. Thanks so much for sharing that. I think somebody had a hand up over here. Yeah, Jane.
Yeah,
and then.
It's been a few years now, but I always think of a time, you know, when you're talking about are there any situations where anger, you know, and ill will does some good. And I just, you know, the work I do, I'm a lawyer and I work on environmental issues. And there's, you know, one time in particular that sticks in my mind, but there have been other times like this too, where when I've gotten angry, you know, change has happened. And I can say, I could tell you specifically the one that I'm thinking about, the city of Hibbing, you know, really undertook a more detailed and extensive mercury control project with their new power plant, I mean, with their new wastewater treatment plant, really because I got really angry on the telephone with somebody. And so I've been curious about that ever since. And when after that happened, I just hated it. I hated it that it was anger that had, you know, seemed to have brought that about. It just didn't seem right to me. And I'm still, you know, all these years later, I'm still really sort of curious about it.
And the question, like, and you can sort of deconstruct it this week, and if there's time, bring it up again next week as you reflect deeply. But sometimes there's anger, but the anger that we're expressing is actually, it's like the holding back, let's say fear was holding us back, like from speaking the truth. Like we didn't want to, you know, there's this sort of, we don't want to make people uncomfortable. or this person is just a cog in this bigger system, and they're not really evil, but they're working for this place, and they don't deserve me making them really uncomfortable to affect this change. So we're holding back because we may not realize it consciously, but I don't really want to be part of this messy interaction. So we might then hold back until the gates can't hold it, and then we speak up. But that may be a positive correction, as imperfect as it is, and there might actually be real anger there, but it might be healthier than somebody holding back for the wrong reasons. You know what I mean? So we have to be a little careful. Just because the interaction was imperfect, it might have been more perfect than the non-interaction that you like not engaging. And so we want to move in the right direction, but we have to let go of this idea of perfection in terms of when we are quiet and when we speak up. Is that time for maybe one or maybe two? Caleb and then Judy?
Well, I was just something to kind of think about in that Jane's example is, I think the element of judgmentalism with the anger is what's really the most detrimental part of it. If you're angry without judgment of someone, it's a little different than a lot of anger with a lot of judgment.
Yeah, and we probably, I mean, for the purposes of this class, when we say anger, it means our heart is closed to that person, right? So there is judgment. But so what you're saying, it's okay to be forceful, or it's okay to be loud, or it's okay to speak in ways that might cause that person to feel pain. That's not anger necessarily, right? Just because somebody's really hurt by our words doesn't mean we're angry. It just means that those words hurt. But sometimes people need to hurt that makes something positive happen. The way we know there's anger is, have we thrown the person out of our heart? Have we kind of congealed an idea of them and made them less than bad or something like that? Like, so that we've reinforced a sense of separation. That's the thing. And we can be powerfully strong and assertive without being angry. I mean, as I'm using the word angry. And we can't tell by how somebody looks on the surface. We can tell in our own heart whether we're angry, but we don't always know whether somebody else, where they're at. Here's a funny story to end the evening. And I'm not justifying this. But anyway, Larry Rosenberg, a well-known teacher in this tradition, was practicing at this beautiful monastery that I've also practiced at in Thailand, Ajahn Mahabua's monastery, a very well-known Buddhist monk who's now dead. But anyway, when Larry was there, Ajahn Mahabua was really laying into one of the monks. He was just yelling. And evidently he had placed a cup too close to the edge of a table. And so Ajahn Mahabua was just laying into him. And then in the middle of this tirade, is that what he said? Anyway, Ajahn Mahabua turns to the translator and says, "Tell him," meaning Larry, "that I'm yelling at the defilements, not the person." And then he went back. So I don't know, and I'm not saying that, you know, when spiritual authorities scream at us. I was with another teacher, who, very well-known teacher, who could express a lot of anger. This is a kind of a famous Indian guru teacher back in the 80s, and he could express real anger at times. And I look carefully, and I had an open mind, like, what was going on in his mind? Like, was he being unskillful, or was he being skillful? And I don't know, even to this day. But we can know. That's the important thing, whether we're throwing somebody out of our heart. And some of you who are parents probably have several examples of really laying down the law, and that line between hating the child and throwing them out of our heart and giving them medicine in a beautiful way. I noticed this as a school teacher, that sometimes, and it wasn't often, but sometimes when I was really forceful, but clean, no real aversion, it was a powerful drug. I felt really high, like in a good way, afterward, like a lot of energy, letting that sort of energy move through you, doing the thing that needed to be done, saying the thing that needed to be said. I'm sure some activists in the room have experienced that. And in the same way, when we're not in a clean place, the after effect doesn't feel good. So we may not notice in the moment, but if we're reflective an hour or so later or the next day and really honest and really cultivate some calm so we can be sensitive, we might notice what's still reverberating and maybe it doesn't feel so good. In the same way that, you know, the next day after an interaction with my wife, I'll know whether it felt clean or not. You know, oh, that didn't feel very good. Not always. Sometimes it felt okay. Sometimes we've really gone at it, and I think, I'm speaking for myself, but I think probably true for Whitney, it felt really clean afterwards, right? Sometimes it's like there's a lot of energy. Like, yeah, that was actually enlivening to kind of let that stuff move a little bit. And we weren't actually throwing each other out of our hearts. We were just, things were moving. Things were being said that need to be said. And that's why it feels so alive now, not dead. So may that be so, that way. And thanks for the comments. We'll have more time next week for discussion. So learn as much as you can this week, and we'll share it next week together. So let's just take a few seconds. Let go of the words.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.